This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Crist. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm delighted to welcome you here today for John Douglas's talk on his new book, the new flagship university model. John has a very unusual career, and I want to tell you a little bit about it. John was an undergraduate at Pitzer College. Then he went to UC Santa Barbara to a program in regional history. And at the same time that he was a student in that program, he started working in the planning department at UC Santa Barbara. So he had, in the years in which he was a graduate student, this kind of double perspective on the academy. He was both a staff member involved in academic planning, involved in the kind of research you do in the planning department, as well as working on his master's degree and then working on his doctorate in history, the result of which was this wonderful book, The California Idea and American Higher Education, which has been my Bible since I became director of the center. It is the authoritative book on the history of the California idea in higher education. He's also written another book, The Condition for Admission, which is about the debate about admission at universities, who gets admitted and on what basis. He subsequently worked at the Office of the President as staff to the Academic Senate, in which he continued to do a lot of analysis, position papers, at the same time that he continued his career as a scholar. And then we were very, very lucky to have him gifted to Berkeley and the Center for Studies in Higher Education, where he is a senior research fellow. John is also the architect of the very big data collecting project on student experience, CERU, Student Experience in the Research University, collects data, survey data on students at mostly public research, AAU research universities in the United States, and also about 15 or so international universities. And it's a really rich and exciting data trove. So I'm so excited to welcome John here, and he's going to tell us about his new book, which you can buy outside for its outrageous price. I'm kidding.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you for noting how expensive the book is. It's really, I fought Pelgrim McMillan on this and lost, and it does make you wonder. But in any case, thank you so much for that kind introduction. And I just want to say a few preface notes before I launch into some slides that I hope will explain in part the idea of the book and some of its main themes. This original idea for the book came about when I was in South Africa. I had an affiliation with a project that's looking at how to develop sub-Saharan African universities that's based out of Cape Town. And there was just this constant rhetoric and feeling of pressure about this concept of world-class universities among a series of universities that are, with the exception of Cape Town and maybe Stellenbosch and a few others, really, you know, are in a different realm, in a different world. So I started saying, well, why don't you start using flagship metaphors? Because obviously I have my historical research and background and knowledge, at least of how American higher education developed in the public's flagships specifically. So I started saying that, and I gave a presentation saying, here's an alternative way of thinking about it. So that was in 2011, I think. So it was a long time ago, and I kept kind of working at it and realizing that, like a good capitalist, there was a market need, and could I figure out a way to provide an alternative narrative that would be attractive? And so that's what this book is partly about. And I will say that this presentation is really focused on an international global audience. It's not really strongly related And there is obviously things related to the American system, but I really focused the book on this larger global world and what's happening with the universities and the policy pressures they're facing from ministries and otherwise. So I begin by saying a couple of just basic things that kind of summarize the intro of the book. It's a familiar, if not fully explained, paradigm. A world-class university, which this concept is quite explicit and ubiquitous, is supposed to have highly ranked research output, a culture of excellence, great facilities, and a brand name that transcends national borders. But perhaps most importantly, the particular institution needs to sit in the upper echelons of one or more world rankings generated each year by nonprofit and for-profit entities. That's the ultimate proof for many government ministries and for much of the global higher education community. But really, what is wrong with this model? I think we can relate to it because it's familiar to us, this concept of the land-grant university and its strong relationship to regional economic development and socioeconomic mobility. That's the history very much of land-grant institutions. But this is a kind of a newer concept or within much of the world in Asia, South America, Africa, but even in Europe to some degree. It's not that the current rankings are not useful and informative. The problem is that they represent a very narrow band of what it means to be a leading or what I call a new flagship university. So I'm taking this language that you're somewhat familiar with and saying, let's look at what it means to be a leading national university in a more broad way. And then I feel that I'm updating this model and talking about it in a more broad way. And I really do think that the universities of today, particularly the large public universities, are not the same institutions they were 40 or 50 years ago in their sheer scope and scale of activities, their budgeting, just a lot of different ways to look at it. Further, WCU advocates, world-class university advocates, do not provide much guidance or knowledge on what organizational behaviors and methods can lead to greater productivity in research, teaching, and public service to best meet the needs of the societies they serve. Now, that's not to the exclusion of the concept that universities are engaged in the process of knowledge production and cutting-edge research and being internationally engaged, but I'm trying to use language that refocuses some of the discussion. So in this brief tour of the book, first I'll just say a few probably familiar complaints about ranking. Something about the ranking and world-class university psychology and its behavioral effects, and a brief discussion of the model. I can't really get into everything. I'll kind of give you just a little conceptual aspect that will look familiar to you. And then I should note, in the book itself, it's structured in a way that I then asked leading scholars in higher education in different parts of the world. Here you can see, look at Asia, Russia, Scandinavia, and South America, and Chile being part of that. Ask them to then look at the model, describe to some degree the history of their leading national universities and how this model makes any sense in their particular part of the world. Now, I'm not going to talk about that too much because that's too much to talk about. But to the rankings, I think you know this. You may be more familiar with the United States structure of rankings, which are really focused on consumer guides. But in the international realm, there's a series of rankings. There are many rankings that are growing like crazy, but there are a couple of big ones that just stand out and that influence ministries and universities greatly. Probably the most significant is the Shanghai Jiao Tong ranking, which was originally funded by the Chinese government in order to get a sense of where Chinese universities were in the realm of research output. But there's also the Times Higher Education ranking and just Qualtrics, and there are just a number of them. So, but what about these? Well, there's not a lot of change at the top in these rankings. And in fact, sometimes the changes in the rankings within, say, 100 or 200 are so small and kind of not very meaningful, but yet they become very meaningful to ministries and to universities who know that they're being evaluated on their rankings. They're heavily biased towards the sciences and engineering, and that's because they're heavily focused on citation analysis. And I think there are huge limits, growing limits in citation analysis. That's because there's a proliferation of journals. It relates partly to the explosion of knowledge, but also there's a lot of demand to create more journal articles and get on lists, government lists, to show, and there's all kinds of other inflation going on with cross-indexing among authors and these kinds of things. And then some, not the Shanghai Jiao Tong, which is one of its strengths, actually, as in terms of its methodology, many have a bias because they have reputational surveys. And I tell you, if I ever get a survey, which I do occasionally, actually I never fill them out, I always put Berkeley number one. So. And you should do the same. Might as well play the game, right? So this is just a really simple way of looking at what the matrix is for most global rankings. As I said before, Shanghai Jiao Tong ranking does not use reputational surveys, and perhaps is a more also it doesn't ask for institutional-based data. You know, when you're asking institutions for data, sometimes they don't necessarily answer exactly in a balanced way. They're conscious of the process. I'll only say that we can see that in SAT score reports to some of the American ranking agencies as well. So there's bias going on and favoritism. But I think the thing I really want to note is that this is a process of ranking that's a bell curve. The concept is that there really are a group of institutions that sit at the top of the bell curve and everybody else, well, you're just not that good. And I don't think that's a very effective or well-reasoned way of thinking about what universities do within their own particular national context. So why is this happening? So one of the reasons is a lack of trust. Ministries are concerned with the overall quality and efficiency of their national systems, and rankings give them a benchmark that they didn't have before. So it fits into this desire and need that also relates to an anxiety that they don't have top-ranked universities that are competitive. And, of course, it feeds into growing both valid and rhetorical information about the knowledge society and how important universities are in that process to be economically competitive. Also, governments need and like goals. So, you know, Tony Blair came out in the late 1990s saying, you know, we're going to have so many universities that are top ranked. I can't quite remember the number now. It was one of the first governments to come out and say that, make that statement. And, you know, it was based on this concept, really an unachievable goal to some degree, if you really took a hard look at it. But there are reasons that politicians put up unreasonable goals or whatever. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of creating expectations. So that's an important thing. And besides, everybody is doing it. So at first, it was a kind of a series of institutions that were leading in this regard. And I will point to Germany as well as being one of the first countries to also not only identify the need to have so many institutions, universities in various rankings, but also to put policy, put together what they call excellence programs to provide funding sources to try to drive that goal towards greater rankings. So, and I will say there are benefits. One, it has often provided new resources, targeted in theory, often, you know, for a specific kind of program, usually not sometimes block grants to institutions, as in China, but often targeted in some form. It's also created a stronger sense of competition among national universities, and that's not all bad. It has made them, for example, become much more engaged in strategic thinking, where they weren't doing hardly any at all. They had a very much of a civil service kind of mentality and structure. One of the things that big changes that is are going on is a significant change, shift from civil service structures of faculty advancement to more performance-based criteria. This is, I think, a very positive thing, although there's lots of noise in that, how they're doing it sometimes. You could you might be astonished at some of the kinds of benefits or you can get if you get a journal article published in this or that journal. So there's some things that are a little bit off on that. But and the other thing is there's been lots of concern that there's this new government money coming in various forms or demands that you know it'll somehow make the universities continue to be the, shall we say, lapdogs of the ministries or the current political regime. But I think there's also a lesson historically to know that academics are really good at taking money and kind of doing what they want with it. If you remember, and I reflect a little bit on a concern about the federal university in the United States in the 1960s with the growth of federal funding after Sputnik, there was lots of discussion here at Berkeley as well about the federal government kind of taking over and controlling. But I think in many ways, universities just knew how to really bend the money in various ways to their own benefit. So I mentioned a few. You may be aware it's just a frenzy of goals out there by various ministries. I'm only mentioning a few of them. And these are stated goals. So Germany, again, I noted began one of the first what they call excellence programs. Again, these targeted kind of programs in order to, with the express purpose to have an influence on rankings and this conceptual link with world-class universities. They want 10 to become elite. Now, I'm not going to tell the exact definition because it varies, top 50, top 100, whatever, usually Shanghai Jiao Tong, but it could be a mix. And believe you me, there's a proliferation of rankings. Everybody's creating rankings of their own that can favor their own institutions. The European Commission has done this. You know, they're so unfair that Shanghai Jiao Tong, you know, we don't have enough German universities in the top 500 or 100 or whatever. And so they create their own ranking structure. But Germany is a very good example. Australia wants 10 in the top 100. Again, never completely fully defined, but basically pointing to the ranking structures of some sort. They'll pick one of them when they figure out where they've when they've done it. France put in $2 billion for initiatives of excellence, very much influenced by the German excellence program. And this was at a time of in the middle of the Great Recession. They were putting money into this, into the, an attempt to elevate the universities in France, understanding that there's a different dynamic with the écoles and all that. China, 20 to match MIT. Russia, 5 in the top 100. Japan also has something, and I think if I didn't reference it here, but I used to, Nigeria is claiming that they're going to have, like, I think 10 in the top 500 in X period, or they're going to define it themselves. They don't say the exact number. So all I can say is do the math. It's a bell curve. Well, you can only have so many institutions. I know you can. Maybe you can have 20 institutions in the top 10. I suppose it's possible, but if you can give 110%, why not? So it's just not reasonable. There are also, and I don't want to dwell too much on it, really significant behavioral impacts on institutions. There are, as I said, national policies on faculty advancement and emerging in many places, or there are versions that are at the institutional level. And they're really focused on citation analysis. Can you get a journal article in X? If you do, you could get a $10,000 raise in your salary or have access to an apartment. Or there are all kinds of things going on that I think we would find within, say, the UC Berkeley culture questionable as to how they're structuring these incentives. Gaming, the UK is a great example. There's a different culture because there's a ranking within the UK and within England that has been ongoing since the early 90s, in fact. And it has been, although they're going through one more reform again, a cycle. And within each of that cycle, you see faculty changing from institution and various deals being made in order to try to get the faculty person with the most citation analysis. And they have a scheme, basically, is that future funding for you in the future is based on past performance. I think that's a questionable way of looking at how to fund research in England. But again, I will say also many of these funding structures also fit into a desire that I think is reasonable, and that is the need for mission differentiation among institutions. Much of this also is an underlying policy issue for ministries. They now recognize that not every institution should be a research-intensive university, so they tend to look at ways of indirect influencing the system. So the world-class university really dominates, and that means it's really focused on very limited ways of looking at research productivity. So I think there are a lot of problems with this, and I think many others do, but instead of just always complaining about it, I'm trying to think of an alternative narrative. World rankings of universities provide one window into a much broader range of activities that leading research universities pursue and accomplish. A narrow band of research activities, as I said. Ranking is here to stay. It's not going away, with the good and the bad. But how to modify and shift this paradigm in this discussion, both externally with ministries and internally within institutions themselves? That's a very tall order. I understand that. But I think I at least have an angle on it to some degree. I also want to make a couple of observations from my viewpoint about top performers, those that you see on the top rankings. Many of them are rather old institutions, or fairly, although look, if you saw, you know, the UCs do extremely well in all of these, and so some are not that old. But current top ranked universities are generally, I would say, have never been and are not built around narrow bands of quantitative measures of research productivity. I don't think we could say that's what drives Berkeley. Obviously, we do want to be productive in research, but we see a much broader range of activities that faculty are engaged in and our purpose in general. And I think still, this is, one might debate this some, but I think the path to national and then therefore international relevance is rooted in larger socioeconomic purpose of the institutions themselves. And within that, and this is something I really emphasize in the book, and again, I think it does reflect a bit of American and UC culture and experience, and that is that internal organizational cultures and practices focused on self-improvement are really the key for institutions to make the next step. Sometimes the ministries and the things that they've done have been very influential in various areas, as I've said, very positive. But I'm trying to argue that at some point the ministries need to back off, that they are not going to make these institutions get up to the next level of really being top performers, whether it's in a ranking or some other way of looking at the institution itself. So that's another message I'm trying to give and hoping it might have some reverberation within ministries. So now I'll try to talk a little bit about what is the flagship model. I've indicated some things about it. So it's what I call the hard part number one, how to define it. This is not an easy task, and it was a bit of a mind twister, and one creates a construct around it. So one of the things I do in the book very briefly, I don't try to dwell on this, is to say, well, here's one way of looking at the public a flagship university, a leading research-intensive institution. Obviously, other institutions can have aspects of this as well, but I think it does reflect to some degree the public institution. For example, in the advancement of a more equitable society. So I don't want to overly focus on this, but it's a kind of a general conceptual idea. You could create your own, I'm sure, that would be pretty close or have as much validity. But I will say that if you do look at this, you can see, well, where does the ranking structures that I just described, how do they fit into, if you kind of agree with this outline of the purposes of an institution broadly defined. You can see it really only relates to creation of new knowledge to some degree. Maybe it leaks a little into productive research environment. Has nothing to do with teaching students or trying to create the next leaders of a nation state or otherwise, or public service or co-curricular activities that we now are understanding more and more are part of a larger series of opportunities for students to grow and mature. Or this also relates to faculty research that has impact on local economies or local governments or communities, for example. And in fact, there is research that tends to show that this ranking structure is pushing out research that we might say is very relevant for local and regional economic development. That, you know, it's not valued in the increasing number of international journals. So there are certain kinds of areas of research that are valued but are not showing up. So this is just kind of a general way of looking at it. But now I want to give you a couple of things that I say in the book, again, trying to construct a way of talking about this. And one is that I say, well, there's a series of flagship assumptions, and this is not the only ones, but these are some of the highlights. Leading national universities are evolving, and the importance and range of programs and activities and expectations of stakeholders are growing, and public universities have to respond in some form to that. I do say, and I do think, mission differentiation. There are some exceptions. We might talk about the German system and its success in terms of being a highly productive research environment, not just the universities, obviously, but the Max Planck Institutes and others. So there are some exceptions to this. But generally, you do need mission differentiation. And I think most governments and ministries now understand that. As I said, they're usually not having an overt discussion about this because it's politically difficult. But they're doing various funding structures to help and reinforce that in some form. I reiterate, it's about internal culture and what I said before about trying to move ministries away from being so invasive and understanding at some point there has to be an internal culture among the faculty and leading administrators to really make gains in the quality of their activities, and always this culture of evidence-based management. It's also this concept that you need to have institutional research capacity. I talk about that, believe you me, that's a very new concept in most institutions, or just marginally understood. That's changing quickly. And I also state that leading flagship universities have a responsibility to the larger system of higher education. Now, that's a really alien thought generally through most of the rest of the world. Because most of the rest of the world, universities are islands into themselves. They don't see themselves as part of national systems, really, except for civil service, maybe, and the faculty and unionization and that kind of thing. But they don't have a strong sense of their responsibility to the larger system. That's starting to change, and there are bits and pieces and stories that are focused on this. In England, the further education sector, conceptually, there's trying to have some regional relationships with institutions. You see that also in Belgium and in the Netherlands. And so it is starting to shift, but it's a big cultural change. And I also mean not just when I say leading, having a nurturing role, that means also creating policies and practices that can be seen as replicated in some form, or having in other institutions, or having formal relationships with other institutions. One area that is constantly discussed about but is very difficult to achieve is this idea of transfer, of students transferring. So that's kind of a newer area, but another example. I also say that generally flagship universities are comprehensive institutions. I don't mean to exclude those that are highly focused on science and engineering, and many universities internationally are. China, for example, heavily invested more in STEM fields than social sciences, and they're weak in the social sciences in these areas. But generally, comprehensive institutions, broadly accessible, this concept that excellence and the potential of human young students is not necessarily based simply on whether you're rich or whatever, but that you have policies that can provide broad accessibility that is sensitive to demographics in your region. I also argue a bit for the concept of service areas. You may not know, but at one time that was a significant part of the University of California's concept of how it would service and enroll Californians. It's kind of dissipated. It's coming back in a little ways, but obviously not unusual. A certain level of autonomy and public finance. Again, I say a movement towards institutional research capacity. And so I'm trying in this structure, which I can't completely describe, to create a common narrative, but one at the same time that is not so limiting that different national cultures and political environments can adapt in some form pieces of it or otherwise to make it their own as well. So that's a bit of a struggle. So now, here's hard part number two, and I'm kind of coming close to the end here. This is the way I try to construct thematically. Well, what is it, as you saw the earlier slide about the objectives and purpose of the public of the new flagship university, which is to my mind very different than the old traditional flagship university, and this is an interesting point brought up by the contributors to the various chapters, is how much their national leading universities, usually depending on where it is, Scandinavia being different than the other examples, really don't understand this broader view of their relationship. For example, in public service and otherwise, and also really dysfunctional management structures internally as well. So there's a lot of things that, that go with that. But so I've outlined a kind of a way of talking about this. And what I do in the book is I outline this construct, and I then provide brief kind of sections, I should say, on each, and then I provide examples. So it's not just that I'm talking about, like for example, student engagement. What are the areas in which universities can be really working hard, or can move towards greater engagement, which I think we see as a value. And then to also give you a reference point, many parts of the world are still struggling with rote teaching methods by faculty. Okay, and this is. It's changing, and there's a real understanding among top institutions and often the ministries that this has to, there needs to be a change and a shift in that, and there are policies for it, and some institutions are doing more than others, but it's a relatively new conceptual idea. So even the idea of learning communities or undergraduate research structures focused on supporting undergraduate research activities and what benefits are from that, those are relatively new. I will say to you as well, though, you know, the structure that we now have around undergraduate research, which is really significant at Berkeley, I think it's really a remarkable story, is very different than it was 20 years ago. The Boyer Report, from some of you remember, came out, and it did have an influence on UC and many other institutions to become much more organized and see value in giving undergraduates a chance to do more organized, often faculty-directed research. So I digress, but that's the kind of thing, and I show examples, whether it's, yes, Minnesota, but also ETH Zurich. I made a conscious effort to look across internationally. I will say there are a lot of examples from Berkeley, as because in the UC system in general, for example, around issues of faculty advancement. One brief example is that many institutions don't have very clear statements as to the expectations they have for faculty, you know, beyond that they teach so many courses, perhaps. but it's not a well-articulated concept as to what they're supposed to be doing and then also what they're being evaluated on, partly because many of them came from very strong civil service structure. They didn't have an evaluation system. That's beginning to change, and it's a very difficult process for many of these institutions. So I do provide those kind of examples. So I won't digress into more of that because that's a big part of the book. And I'll tell you one thing. It wasn't a lot of fun to write. It was very difficult and a little bit laborious, but I felt like it was something that would be useful for the goals that I've outlined for the book. So finally, a few concluding remarks. This book implies a high level of policy and practice convergence among leading national universities. This is an area of debate among scholars of higher education, and particularly when you go to Europe, there's lots of dislike of the ideas of hierarchy, and questions about cultural imperialism, other things. But I think I've been in this argument for a while, and I think there's a lot of the higher ed scholars have erred on the side of not really recognizing the tremendous level of policy transfer that's going on in the modern era, where we're looking out over our shoulder and seeing what our competitors are doing. It's really a remarkable thing. And so I often ask this question, is there such a thing as a Russian way to have a research-intensive university, a Chinese way, a German way, a Scandinavian way? And I think there probably is at the edges, but it's a remarkable level of convergence if you look at the policy realms that I've talked about and see the attention that these institutions are beginning to pay about it. Governance is another area. Really significant changes going on related to governance. It's a long haul. It's not meant as a litmus test. I keep saying that. It's there for adaption. It's aspirational. It's not supposed to be something that describes an institution in one moment in time, but it kind of gives an idea, aspirational idea of what institutions might be looking at and how to change the rhetoric related to world-class universities. So it's not a litmus test, but there also has to be enough commonality in my story in order to make it somewhat compelling. I do have this little section in the book where I kind of go through these problems and go, I don't know if I can solve all of them. But another is to ask the question, well, how does one become a flagship university or use that rhetoric? Do you need to be appointed by the ministry to do such and gives it some money? Or is it a self-identity? I don't answer that because I think I'm hoping that it depends on the circumstance. And again, you know, this is perhaps wishful thinking on my part. So it was difficult to create a common narrative. I will say that I suffer a bit from U.S. Berkeley bias affliction. It's a disease that we all have, I think, to some degree. But that's the nature of scholarship to some degree in this kind of an area. Obviously, the model I'm pushing and trying to say might be a narrative that somehow could be adopted in different parts of the world is non-quantitative. It doesn't really lend itself to matrix and the kinds of things that ministries and many universities desire. To rank it in some form. I mean, you could imagine some, and there's some that try to do these more broad-based efforts. There are many other rankings that are trying, but it's very difficult to have consistent data and it's broadly recognized. So ministries really want metrics. So now I'm saying this model has no chance at all. So, but here's my final thought. The flagship model provides a path for some universities to explain and seek a revised institutional identity to help them build a stronger internal culture of self-improvement and ultimately a greater contribution to economic development and socioeconomic mobility rates that all societies seek. I think that's a kind of one way of saying the importance of flagship national public universities. But for that to happen, some group of institutions will need to embrace some version of the model on their own terms and articulate it clearly and loudly. So that's kind of the way I've concluded. I will say I have a little hope. There will be a conference in Zhejiang University around the book's themes We have one of our visiting scholars from Zhejiang here, Mosey Wang, and they'll have a conference around how does it fit within the Asian world, and another publication will come out of that. So with that, I'll take some questions. Thank you very much.
I have a question that might be a little bit opposite of what you're thinking about, helping other universities become flagships. I'm wondering, as a historian, if you have any sense of how universities that have been at the top for a long time get dislodged. You may have noticed we're in crisis. We're having a staggering debt right now. We're being asked by the governor and the president to take over 1,000 new students next year and an additional 1,000 the year after. We don't have anywhere for them to sleep or classes for them to take. What will it take to dislodge Berkeley? Oh, we're also going through a strategic planning process that's probably going to happen too quickly because of being driven by financial crisis. So I'm just a little worried. And so what can you tell us about how universities, if you know of any, that have gotten dislodged? I mean, it's taken us 150 years to establish this reputation. How long does it take to ruin it?
Well, I think the line usually is that, you know, it's a very short period to ruin a university. But I will say, if we rely on the Times Higher Ed ranking, in which about 30%, I think, of the ranking is reputational, we'll do just fine, because there's a huge legacy effect. But
that's not reassuring enough, sorry.
No, I don't know. But on the more serious side,
we have something very precious here, as you probably know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I think there are people in this room who are more knowledgeable than I about what the campus is facing, and it does seem very significant. And I think, I still have a hard time understanding at the moment, although I will, I understand that there are broader needs for Berkeley to service California. But to continue to grow when it doesn't have a financial model in order to really sustain that, and I think the big area I look at often, although it's hard to get accurate data, is faculty-to-student ratios, and to see those numbers going up. So my question would be, and I know that Andrew Zeri and others are obviously very concerned about this, and the chancellor, is that, you know, when you're at, I know the system-wide average is 21, almost 21 to 1 graduate and undergraduate. Berkeley's probably somewhere close to that. You're pushing at the edge of the other institutions that we know are competitive in the U.S. And I think I would say generally, if I understand, Michigan is more like 15 to 1 or something like that. And if you look internationally, usually it's like 17 to 1 or something like that. But again, there are the troubles with numbers on this, because how you count faculty and all this stuff. So it is a big concern. There's still time. The question is how to right that ship. But I feel, I feel that the university like Berkeley should take its lumps and do its job in taking on students. But I don't know how you can figure out a financial model to continue that without some other leverage of resources. And obviously tuition is a significant one. I like to say that tuition can be too high and it can be too low. And it's both about access, and we know now that, so far Berkeley's done a pretty good job at maintaining the demographic mix, at least socioeconomically. We've actually grown in low-income students in the last 4 or 5 years. But it's all the other part of the equation is what are the resources provided to the institution? And again, I think faculty-student ratios are a good way to look at it. I don't know if there's anybody else who would like to make a comment about that question. No.
Thanks for a fascinating presentation. I'm curious what universities you might point to in particular, say, over the information technology age that have somehow transformed their position on some of these lists. And I'm asking this in the context of developing an online university that's MIT OpenCourseWare centric in 7 languages, and Wiki also. Wikipedia is in 300 languages. We'd like to have universities in all countries' main languages. What would you suggest if we're at all lucky enough to be incubated by the University of California and WASC Senior, which accredits Cal and Stanford, for example? What would you suggest?
Well, I do talk a little bit about online education in the book, and this is kind of like you're hopping around a lot of topics, and it's not a super long book, and I couldn't figure it all out anyway. So, and I do think in terms of extension and these kinds of things, that this is a really important aspect of reaching out both to Californians and to others throughout the world. I think it is a question as how it fits into the normal structure of degree programs. I think we all are probably familiar with the New American University and Arizona. But as far as I can tell on the Arizona example, it's really two classes of students. There's the online class of students and the on-campus. And so that's for a university like Berkeley or UC, that's a big question. Are we going to have a really different structure of providing education in the normal degree program? I mean, I could argue at least looking at some of the attrition rates and some evaluation of the effectiveness of online education. Again, I have a feeling you're much more of an expert than I am on this, is that, you know, it's questionable for 18 to 24-year-olds. And that's another really important aspect of online education, is how it fits with certain demographic groups. I think so far we haven't seen a lot of efficiency at the 18 to 24-year-old level. The attrition rates are extremely high. So at least it's a really important part of the puzzle. I still, for a leading flagship university, I tend to see it more as a way to expand services, much as Extension did in the 1890s to the agricultural community. And so that's a very important part. But that element of how it fits in with the structure of the institution and are we creating different classes of students is something I think is still weighs on the minds of places like Berkeley.
A number of the countries that are trying to get 20 universities in the top 10 are countries with very autocratic cultures. And I wonder if you have thoughts about the relationship of, if not democracy as a form of government, a relatively open intellectual, culture of open intellectual debate and democratic traditions as important to developing world-class universities.
Flagship. It's okay. It's so pervasive. Yes, this is a part of in the book. Absolutely, I point to, for example, statements of academic freedom. I try to shop around so I could show that there are many different institutions with approaches, and I use Columbia and showed their statement on academic freedom, but I also provide the Haifa statement, if you're aware of the Haifa statement, that included the AU and European Commission and also I think Australian universities and some Chinese universities as well about academic freedom, and say every institution needs to have some kind of clear statement about academic freedom, that faculty are an important component of it, but it also extends to what rights and privileges students have. And so this is problematic to some degree. I then do talk, I have this, again, this kind of more contemplative section of the book where I jump around on different issues and say, you know what, if you're in a society that has severe gender discrimination, you can't have a flagship university. I try not to overplay that, but basically say within the realms of the things I'm talking about and the role of these institutions in socioeconomic mobility, if you share my value, that's an important component for a leading national university. You know, many privates that do function like that to some degree as well, many Catholic universities in various parts of the world as well. But the leading national universities are really important in that overall ability to have mobility. And obviously, I think the Middle East is very problematic to ever being able to achieve a model like this. I do make some statements about open societies as well. And so I think it raises the question, although not directly, about what that means for places like China. But I leave that I say it's aspirational. I'm not trying to create dividing lines that say you'll never do this or that, and I don't say that. but that these are the values, and I'm hoping that occasionally maybe a ministry will pick this up. You know, you have to understand ministries, right? And I know we have some people who are very expertise in here. We have Rory Hume, who knows these things well, is that, you know, you go to, you look at these ministries in many places, it's a revolving chair thing. There, you know, it was the guy who was in transportation who's now leading the higher ed side, and their level of knowledge is often not that great, or there's a very bureaucratic structure around it. I very much admire the Japanese universities to some degree, but the bureaucracy of the ministry and things is like, you can't believe how many people are employed in the ministry and what the structures are going on. So I'm at least, again, trying to be aspirational and say, well, look, this is an important consideration. If you really want to have a top-level institution, a flagship in this form, you have to have certain basics that are lined up. I also note in this vein, and discuss and show examples of other very interesting studies in South Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa about what are the basic things that they need to have in that kind of environment, you know, in Uganda or in other various other parts of Sub-Saharan Africa. And they need to have so many faculty, you know, who have PhDs, and they need to have a pipeline for that. So there are other pieces of that story that are similar about criteria, that it's very difficult to achieve that without having, for example, an academic, I use the language from this project in South Africa called the Academic Core. So I explain that. So there are other criteria like that.
Sort of a follow-up to Carol's question. It's not only an issue in authoritarian regimes, but it seems also the basic contradiction that I see played out in some of your examples is a ministry or a government setting a goal, top-down goal, to increase the number of world-class institutions or world-class universities. But your conclusion that to be successful, whether a democratic or an authoritarian regime, you need to have an internal culture. I associate that with disciplines, professions, where faculty judge each other's work rather than having the work be judged by some outside. That has to be very strong for a university to advance scientifically or any discipline. So isn't there a basic contradiction between the desire of most of the countries that you've listed, this top-down approach to increasing world-class universities, and the solution, the internal culture that you described to be at the heart of the process?
I wouldn't call it a contradiction. It's a challenge, mm-hmm. and it varies by where you are. So in the analysis provided by the other chapters and in things I've done with others is the internal management structure is a big, big issue in the ability of institutions to achieve this internal culture, and also lack or just beginning to understand the need for institutional research, and that there's something called, you know, it's a rhetorical term to some degree, but evidence-based management. Sorry to use that term. But so, you know, I think it's not a contradiction. It's a major challenge. And I think we will see many of these institutions maybe in a different place in 15 or so years. And the reason is partly is there are a lot of shifts going on in that structure of governance. And France is an example in which institutions have been given much more authority to manage their resources internally, given more authority, not without criticism and concern as to how it's going to work towards the rector or whatever equivalent that is, the president. And then what are these relationships between faculty and administrators? I think I do discuss this, and it is a very big challenge. And you'll see big differences between, say, France or Brazil, where things are highly political, that the leadership is often aligned with particular parties, political parties, and the students are as well. So two examples in which you're seeing really significant improvements in internal management of institutions as well. So it's a broad range, but it is a major challenge for many institutions. And Again, looking at Chile and South America, that's a major component of their discussion. But what I will say is eventually, and I do discuss this, if you're talked about internal quality assurance, I point to the basics, and that is hiring and advancement of faculty and the criteria that it's based on, that it's not civil service. I mean, there's difficulties with that. Program review as being another element of the internal cultural aspect of what you're doing. I have less faith in accreditation, depending on where, you know, what how it's done. So,
John, I have a question about mechanisms to cultivate a flagship. If I were sitting in a government ministry and I have two bags of tricks, one would be, let's say, financial mechanisms to encourage flagship-like behavior on the part of my university, or on the other hand, provide autonomy and follow-up to that university. Which is a better path, looking at the history of what's been tried to cultivate?
Well, there's another path related to this, and that is getting back to Saul's question, is governance and management structure. And so if you do see there have been steps being made for many leading national universities, whether it's China or whether it's Japan, of creating greater levels of autonomy and ability, for example, often sometimes developing something like a board, similar to ours. So that's been one element of what ministries have been doing sometimes, providing that level of stronger internal management control by the institutions themselves. There's kind of a breaking point. At some point, I don't know what that is. At some point, I don't think that ministerial edicts about how to evaluate faculty or others are going to have the positive effects on institutions as opposed to trying to put pressure on them to do their own internal management and improvement in their overall management. So I think the early stage was exactly what you said, provide money in order to induce behavior. And now the question is, can there be some kind of a transition to stronger autonomy of the institutions themselves?
The one presidential candidate who's speaking about higher education a lot is actually Marco Rubio, and he has these four points very, very carefully laid out.
I thought you were going to say Sanders.
No, actually.
Okay, Sanders, go ahead.
Sanders is just basically talking about fees. Rubio has a much longer speech.
Okay, yeah.
And he starts with accreditation. He starts with his own experience of student debt. He begins with a speech saying that he believes that the accreditation system is basically a scam. And that there is this much better way of delivering courses online, but they're not accredited. That's true and it's not true. I mean, you can actually, he mentions Coursera and Udacity, for example, and you can, get for an extra $50, get certification from Coursera, which actually is not such a bad idea. But my question is totally open-ended here. It's by no means impossible that Rubio will be your next president. It's not likely, but it's not impossible. How would you advise him?
I don't think Mr. Rubio would listen to me. You know what? I think the rhetoric. I'm not fully knowledgeable about everything he said. I know he gave a speech, and I see him very much aligned with the former Bush administration as to what they were trying to do. They were trying to get a hold of accreditation as a process to provide, you know, the CDL, a version of the CDL of learning outcomes tests, and to provide much greater. The Bush administration opened the gates for tremendous growth in the for-profit university sector. So, the tendency of Republicans has been we need market solutions and the for-profit sector, although that rhetoric has died a little bit because of so much of the abuse that's been exposed. And I would say the credit to the Obama administration, and they've used the process of doling out financial aid. Again, the United States, we don't have a ministry of education so far. And the two areas, the major areas that they have influence is research expenditures and financial aid, and to some degree accreditation, which relates to funding of financial aid. So I don't know. I tend to think of the Republicans just being continuing the line that the Bush administration did before and would push that angle as much as possible, and obviously would not be looking on the other side, which I will say, although I think it's much concern about the Sanders and the approach that Hillary Clinton has expressed, as far as you can figure it out, because it's all very vague, in terms of their policy positions on higher education, is the positive part of that is that, you know, they've really identified disinvestment by states as the critical factor, not the rhetoric of rising costs, which is, you really have to unpack rising costs in terms of operational costs, you know, community colleges versus a major research-intensive university. So they've really done that, and they have identified the for-profits as being a problem, and it really is a big problem. If you look at debt, at the debt levels in the United States, nearly, I think it's nearly half, or maybe it's 40% of outstanding debt is in the for-profit sector, and they by far have the most students who go by default as well. So the positive, even though I'm worried about what it means, and the concept of block grants was, in fact, again, going back historically, if you look at, there was a very similar debate about how the federal government should fund higher education in the 1960s. And in fact, right here in Berkeley, the Carnegie Commission for Higher Education came out with a series of very important reports that argued, no, you should fund students to then be in the marketplace within some controls, then giving block grants to states or to institutions themselves. But sorry, the positive part is that I think it's identified disinvestment by the states as a major component, and the for-profits are a problem as well. So I think that's a really positive development, that that's part of the political national discussion.
John, thank you and well done. I think that the world-class university ranking thing is totally toxic and really dangerous for higher education. And so you're giving an alternative...
trying.
Yeah, you're trying. and strength to your arm, and I hope you succeed. It'd be fabulous for individual governments to pick up on this concept rather than trying to push universities into Shanghai Jiao Tong by lying, cheating, and stealing, which many of them are doing. But that's just my preliminary comment. And you're using this flagship thing, and I think that's a great idea. But a flagship usually has to have a fleet. And for us, that's obvious. You know, the UC system is the flagship. The fleet is the rest of the master plan. And it's wonderful, you know, and like everything else, California shows the world how it can and should be done. But what is Caltech's fleet?
Well, I would not necessarily call Caltech a flagship in my definition. But the other thing I should say is it's a point, again, another contrast between the United States and the rest of the world, with a few rare exceptions, is that we are a nation of systems, national systems of higher education. If I remember right, around 75% of all the students who are in higher education are in systems, loosely defined. You call the community colleges a system, but it is. And so when I talk about these relationships with, I'm sorry, I should say, most parts of the world, as I said before, institutions really are islands. They may have their own little small fleet, like Beijing Normal University has a fee-paying, money-generating operation. It's not the main campus. This gets a little back to what you talked about, in which they're creating, because demand is so high, different kinds of parts of the corporation, shall I say. But I think, you know, this concept of systems is not going to emerge in the rest of the world. And when I talk about flagships, I'm really talking about having this larger socioeconomic role. But I struggle a little bit with it, and having ties with other systems, not owning them, but being partners with them. I think a great example is KU Leuven in Belgium is doing interesting work with other institutions in the region. So I'm not, my definition isn't flagship in that form. It's more of a leader that is providing by example or by relationships, as opposed to ownership. But that is a really interesting aspect that's different, and it also affects the public discourse about higher education in other parts of the world. Because in the United States, at least we've had a history in California in which the leadership of the University of California, although many of you may not remember this too well, but felt obligated that we were part of this larger system and we took a leadership role. In ancient history, the Berkeley campus developed the concept of the AA degree and was the accreditor and one of the chief proponents of the community college. So that related, for reasons that also fit its needs, that's ancient history, I realize, but that conceptual idea of being linked and speaking, the leadership of the university speaking for public higher education in some holistic way, that doesn't exist in the others. You see a little pieces of it in these growing groupings of alliances like the Russell Group in the UK, in which they kind of, but they're basically associations to preserve their own. So
we have time for two more questions.
Okay, well, anyway, at the risk of asking a question,
but Henry, you weren't here for the earlier part of my talk.
That's what I'm about to say. Caught in traffic from Palo Alto, which is always a good excuse. In fact, I asked the question yesterday at a celebration at ScanCore at Stanford, where they're announcing a sister group to start at the H School. And I said, and at that sister group, it'll basically be the virtual Boston University. And I asked, why not in this area, in the Bay Area? Don't we have that virtual Bay Area University? And there was no good answer to that. Somebody said traffic. Okay, and today I was caught somehow by a machine that took us over the Bay Bridge. So that's why I missed your talk. It's all by following one of those machines. Never do that. Okay, so, to get a little closer to the question, one thing your comments inspire was, I'm from the SUNY system. 30-year sentence. Got released about 10 years ago to come to Stanford. But there, I saw over the years a de-systemification. When I first there was the old building at Albany, formerly headquarters of a railroad system that the university took over. But gradually, the building emptied out as SUNY could no longer afford the bureaucracy that was supposed to run it. And now we see the more complete de-systemification. It's no longer SUNY Stony Brook or even SUNY Purchase. It's Stony Brook University. And all of these schools have gotten their independence. And I think we're seeing that a little more slowly. It's a little more hidden in UC, but it's happening. And UCSF made an explicit move for independence. Let's see what happens to it. But that is the way things are going. We're seeing de-systemification. And that's what you're seeing in Europe as well. And now on the other hand, the trends going in the other direction, like KU Leuven or Karolinska, what's happening there is that these universities are incorporating the smaller schools around them because they need larger masses. Okay? And so they're taking over faculty lines. I watched the Karolinska move across Scandinavia, across Sweden, not only to encompass all the health related universities, but also the social work university, anything to get another line, because they know that over a generation, you can take over that line and put whoever you want into it.
Okay, so can I respond?
In a minute. I want to get to a question for you.
Well, you had a question. And what I want to say is that you pointed to California, and I think, you know, this is something that I think we're all concerned with, but it's a direct relationship to significant disinvestment in a public university that generally is, I think, fairly cost-effective. I mean, we could argue about aspects of that. But if you look at certain data about the cost of educating a student, which is difficult, but it's consistent, you see a decline in the amount of money we're spending per student, is that this level of disinvestment threatens the system, threatens this conceptual
That's
idea.
That's not my question.
Well, but you did bring that up, and
yeah,
I did want to state that.
Yeah, but it's not my question. Okay, because that's all been taken care of. You've dealt with that in the book, and we take that for granted. Okay? But I would like to, following up on the political question, okay, Rubio is mentioned, and Sanders. But the actual person who's president is Obama. And the actual head of the virtual higher education ministry has been Mrs. Biden, who is a professor at a community college.
Okay, but where's the question?
The question is, are we turning the whole thing on its head and the community colleges becoming the leading model rather than the flagship universities?
Well, I would tell you that no. That the higher education, this is where people sometimes get, I think, a little misled, is a market of diversified providers, that there is lots of room for many different types of institutional types, including online, and that we are in a world, particularly outside of the U.S., of growing demand for both enrollment and the products and things that we produce in universities. So my sense is that that will retain itself, and that Peter Drucker is wrong, that brick-and-mortar institutions will remain a vibrant component of a larger, diversified grouping of institutional providers. And that'll be the case in California. Like, I'm not against for-profit institutions. I'm just against the ones that are really bad. And we have a lot of those. And we've had them. California's had diploma mills since the 1920s. So this is an area with greater regulation or self-regulation that can improve, and there's a definite and significant role for that part of the market, relatively new part of the, or growing part of the market.
Final question. So could you elaborate on the relationship between an institution's internationalization efforts, however you might define it, with the flagship model? And on that note, what are your thoughts on the plans for a Berkeley Global Campus and how that fits or does not fit with the flagship model?
Well, on the last one, I think we have some people in the room who can answer the question better than me. I'm still learning. But I would say I do have a section in the book about international engagement. I knew that I had danger here in the way that I tried to put a lot of rhetoric about, if again, the title of the book is Global Ranking to National Dash regional dash local relevancy, and but I, as I state in the book, that's not to say that institutions should not be internationally engaged. It's just the matter of where it sits in the larger framework of what they're doing. Some institutions think that international, particularly in China or other places, that international engagement equals one, policy transfer, and two, a path towards higher rankings in some form. And they put so much of their energy into this particular area. I remember at Tangji University not so long ago asking them about how many joint degree programs they had, and they told me 95. I said, 95? And how big are they? They're just little things, you know. But it was all about creating these relationships without a lot of meaning or direction. So in the book, I say that, you know, that this isn't mutually exclusive to international engagement. It's a very important component. But there are a lot of institutions who are not being selective about what they're doing or thinking strategically about their what they're doing. And I do use some pieces of a taxonomy that came out of a paper, and we hope eventually a book that I'm working on with with Richard Edelstein. And Grace Teneri is also here as a visiting scholar helping us on that. But in this taxonomy, which I put up, you know, it says, what are the range of things and what's the areas of effort? And I would say when you look at where perhaps a version of the global campus sits on that range, from, you know, simply having student exchanges to a branch campus or shared physical facilities, that's a high level of effort. So at least I, without a lot of judgment or knowledge, I would say that Berkeley has done some of a job of saying, okay, we're not going to have MOUs with everybody and their mother. Perhaps we're going to be strategic about what joint degree programs we have, even though we're asked by billions of institutions all the time to do it, because it's, again, about, it's partly about show, it's about courtesy, and these kinds of things. And the flagship Berkeley Global Campus, I don't know enough about it. It seems interesting to me, and that's about all I can say about it.
Well, on that note, let's thank John. you can hear John speak again. We're sponsoring in a little less than a month, about 3 weeks, a national symposium on undergraduate education in the Public Research University, and John is going to talk about what we can say about student engagement in a public research university from the CIRU data that that we have so many years of and so many institutions worth of now. So I hope that I see some of you at that symposium. You have to sign up on the website. It's March 10th and 11th. And now please join us for a reception outside.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.